That remains, and maybe you can help me with this, is how, when these people, the people who stayed Jewish and who did all these kinds of things, why what they did not offer them any protection about sinking into mire. And they did such heroic things. They lost their children, they took abuse, they did all these kinds of things, and yet whatever they did didn't save them from sinking. Just talking about how they sunk down to this 49th level of Tumma while they were doing things which led them to be in enslavement, intimacy with their wives, Jews.
They spent 126 years in Egypt.
As long as any of the original 70 who descended to Egypt were alive, slavery was the Egypt knew that it could not just straight without some sort of subterfuge just take this nation and enslave them. They had to do it in stages so that somehow it would become acceptable. They're judged because of the intensity of the affliction. It was way beyond what was called for. So there's this comment in Vayechi that when Yaakov Avinu died, the hearts and the eyes of Israel became obstructed. So what that implies is as follows, that between someone who is free and someone who is a slave, there are many levels, there are many gradations. The likelihood is that someone in any one of the forms of, let's say, contemporary slavery does not become a slave, does not go from a place of freedom and dignity into a place of utter slavery in one fell swoop. It happens as people become gradually accustomed to certain things. We are accustomed today to a certain standard of living, certain creature comforts. There are some people who became accustomed to TV or the internet, and that didn't happen. It didn't go from nothing to 8 hours a day in one second. It happened over a period of time. It just became more and more somehow captivated or captured by whatever they were doing. Maybe that alcohol is a little bit more captivating, and drugs even more captivating, but money for sure. At least those people who become pathologically involved with money probably is more insidious. It's much more respectable. And in our society, it's really kind of the measure of success and failure. I remember being in the office of a very prominent businessman who was competing at the time for a city contract against some very powerful groups. And it had been reported in the newspapers over a period of weeks about the different groups and how they were vying for this contract and what it was worth and all that. So I just happened to be there when the phone rang, and it was the mayor's office informing him that the common council had just awarded a contract to him. And he was just, you know, he was really all charged up. And then, now he's in the office, so I congratulated him, everybody in the office was rejoicing. And then he turned to me and he said to me, he says, you know, he said, I really didn't need this. And he said, I have plenty of money. I didn't need this. He said, but it's the competition. It's the, in essence, it's the hunt. The point over here is that slavery of any kind is something which goes through many, many subtle stages and changes in attitude. Such things as the people who came here, the immigrants who came here, worked very hard, but if you would have stopped them at any time and said to them, you know, like, what's your priority? Why are you working so hard? I'm working for my family. My family is very important, you know. They would have told you that their family is more important than they are, and, you know, that's worth all of that work, and they're very dedicated. And if they would have spoken to them about charity, they would have told you that charity is one of the great values and that they need. Over time, that value yielded to an American priority, which put people for themselves first. It was looking out for number one. Many people attribute that change, or that either it was fueled by or reflected by Ayn Rand's philosophy on life, Atlas Shrugged. You know, it was replaced. I come first. And that there's no question about the fact that I come first is right now where America's at. That's why the family's falling apart. The relationships in the family are competitive. Husbands and wives are competitive. Husbands and parents and children are competitive. It's not. The entire concept of trust and going beyond yourself is. In any event, the issue of the extent to which we become beholden to things which draw our energy, our values, our attention, we don't even come into question, are all things that happen very, very subliminally. As long as Yaakov Aminu was alive, he was able to note every subtle influence on the authentic, pure outlook of a Jew in his world. So he would immediately say, as soon as whatever, he would immediately say to his children, I want you to know what that advertisement for a car means. You need to understand what it's saying to you. You need to understand what that particular fashion is, what the implications of that are. When our society went over from, let's say, from speaking about the institution of marriage, and that there was something called alternative lifestyles, or when there was now a category called consensual. No, it's not. This is not. It's consensual. When we went over to things, when talking about the end of life decisions, we went over to something called quality of life. Or we don't understand when people rally around at this. I mean, these the stupidity that goes on right now in liberal circles, what it means, but when you're talking about beginning a left, but pro-choice. You know, somebody needs to stand up and say, here is where this logic is flawed. I mean, you know, let's expose that. I mean, where this thing is really a gross violation of reason, of dignity, of whatever. I mean, you know, so Yaakov Avinu could spot the moment these things. You know, it's very interesting. I remember in the 1950s when I was in yeshiva. So this was shortly after the Satmar Rebbe had come to America. He came to America after the war. He was one of the few who managed to make it. And he immediately denounced, this was in the early 50s, he immediately denounced TV. And what he said about it was, it is idolatry, it's murder, it's violence, and it is immorality. Early 50s. Now, we had a TV set. We had a TV set in the early 50s, and it was none of those things. None of those things. It was clean. It was Howdy Doody. It was Milton Berle. It was the Goldbergs. It was Maury Amsterdam. There was nothing on TV. They had conservation shows. That was like, I mean, it was garnished. I mean, there was nothing on TV. We had this huge console. This huge console, 10-inch screen.
Most of what was on TV was that circle.
Right. That was it. So I remember marching around decrying the fact that, what was this man talking about? Why was he, was he carrying on about this? This was so off the chart. It was so ridiculous, so unrealistic. He saw everything. I mean, it was it was barely a little tiny ovum at the time. But he saw that TV represented this march into this abyss, and he was absolutely 1,000,000,000% correct. Well, so the point is that on the one hand, as long as any of the 70 members of the original family who came down was alive, there could not be any slavery, because the physical world is really an extension of our spiritual world. What happens to us physically is what we allow to. If we become spiritually somehow enslaved, then that's what happens to us. If we want to free ourselves from the different forms of bondage and servitude on a physical level, we really have to free ourselves on a higher level. That's because we're busy fighting the battle in the wrong place. And Egypt could not enslave a nation that was aware of the ways in which the soul becomes so. The slippage began in the time of the moment that Yaakov died, because there was no one who was as critically sensitive as he was. But the moment that the last one of that family died, then there was no one to cry out. There was no one to scream.
That was only after 17 years. That was only after 17 years.
Well, that's the initial part of it. The last of the 70 didn't die until they had been there already for about 100 and whatever I told you before.
Yeah, you mean all of
them. Yaakov died, that's when that's dull. Yeah, that began to be dull. But it's, there still were people around. And it was once the guy in the Vilna guy would learn. Anyway, so the guy would learn for 20 hours out of every 24, he was engrossed in the materials. Someone said to him, you know, why is he so heavily committed? So he said, if the Vilna, and he told himself, going to Vilna, he says, studies Torah 20 hours a day, then the judges of Vilna will study Torah 16 hours a day. If the judges, the Dayonim of Vilna, study for 16 hours a day, then the Rabbanim of Vilna will study 12 hours a day. If the Rabbanim of Vilna study 12 hours a day, then Balabatim of Vilna will study 6 hours a day. He says, but if I were to study anything less, he says, that's going to ripple right down the line. He says, it's going to have its impact on them. Anyway, to kind of address Howard's question, and we did talk about this several weeks ago, as I recall, the forms of the 49 levels of Tumah are such that even if you maintain your own identity, and I remember that we talked about the fact that we might, even today, we could go into Williamsburg, or we could go into the village of Square or Monroe, where they have their own intact world, as it were. We could go into even Mea Shearim. But we would discover that the fact that everybody in the world breathes the same polluted air, and that everybody in our world, for all of the big walls that we throw up, everything is so permeable that there are attitudes, and that there are needs, and growing dependencies on things that are true today about people, even in the religious insular world, which is a product of the world in which we live. And I remember saying over here a couple of weeks ago that if some prophet were to come upon the scene and do an evaluation of where we're at, I don't think I would want to know what level of compromise we are today, because I think it would be very substantial, because there's stuff that goes on. I mean, it's not even nice to talk about it, but if you were to take even in the very religious world, you know, that the things that people are into, and it covers the entire gamut. You know, it's how you treat another person, how you speak about another person. The allowances that people make for themselves in their business ethics. Now, everybody does it. It's just part of it.
Do you feel that the Monroe model works, or is it just sort of delays an inevitable process? Monroe is a settlement community in upstate New York.
It's they built their own. They built their own city. So they have, let's say, several thousand people who live in this enclave. It's all by itself, off in the country. If you want to get there, you got to drive an hour and a quarter from the city of New York to get the square or the. Which is one town, I forget the. Totally for the Chassidic. Totally. You walk through the streets, I mean, that's all you'll see are people of Chassidic commitment. The entire city.
But does it really solve the problem? Is it what we're really supposed to be doing?
I think anything that we can do is worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can throw up a wall that will give us, you know, another inch of protection, it's worth it. Being bombarded by the stuff that's going on at whatever, 20 decibels less, or whatever it is—it's worth it. It's worth it because any integrity that we can eke out, or any quality that we can eke out, even for a few, I don't know, for the gain of a few yards of turf, is worth it. And the answer to the question, does it work? It doesn't work because nothing today works. It can't. The forces are too formidable, and we'd have to go to some place like in the Himalayas, I think. And
so, living in ghettos is the answer.
Living in ghettos is—that's another. You buy yourself a little bit more insurance. It's not a home. We get calls from parents in from Spring Valley, from Sutton. We got a call 2 years ago from a mother in Sutton whose daughter had been working in the office, and she got to hear some talk shows, and now she had brought home a radio and she was listening to these talk shows. It wasn't the end of the world, but she was gravely concerned about the fact that her daughter was slipping in there. I mean, it's very, very hard. But I mean, I think part of the moral of all of this is that I think that if we can, to the extent that we can buy extra space, I think it's obligatory to do it. That's why when I addressed the subject of the internet over here a couple of years ago, I begged people to keep the internet out of their homes. And if they were going to keep it in, then they needed to do it with a filter, because otherwise they were just setting themselves up for some huge, huge risks. And several months ago, somebody came to see me, a parent, he came to see me to tell me that his wife came down in the middle of the night. And she woke up, she needed to go get something, and she found her teenage child at a porno site. And when they began to look back at the, you know, how the computer had been used, so the parents said, "So, what do I do now?" I said to them, "Were you there when I spoke about this?" He said, "Yes." So he said, "But I thought that it wasn't going to affect me." I mean, you know, he wasn't being malicious over here. He just wanted to be smart, and you can't afford to be smart over here. And my answer to him was, "There's nothing you can do, because those images will never go away. If there is something that we need to learn from the example of Egypt, it's one that slavery happens in very subtle gradations." And B, that even when you're heroic in maintaining your identity, and which the majority of from Jews today can speak to with some pride, but that doesn't mean that we're not compromised by what's going on. We're all deeply affected by and compromise.